This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. We're online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Why, when we mean to do the right thing, we from time to time make things worse? Making things worse, making blunders, happens to individuals and within families. It also happens in business, politics, and in government. Blunders happen locally and globally. Our guest this afternoon is historian Zachary Shore. He is the author, most recently, of Blunder: Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. Shore says blunders, though, are not inevitable. He says, quoting here, "We can all make wiser decisions by cultivating empathy and imagination." So this afternoon, we'll look at how and why we make bad judgments and how we can become better decision makers. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Zachary Shore is an associate professor of national security affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School and a senior fellow at UC Berkeley's Institute of European Studies. In addition to Blunder, Zachary Shore is the author of Breeding Bin Laden's America, Islam, and the Future of Europe, and What Hitler Knew, The Battle for Information in Nazi Foreign Policy. His latest book, Blunder: Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions, is published by Bloomsbury. And you'll find our guest, Zachary Shore, online at www.zacharyshore.com. And that's S-H-O-R-E. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Zachary Shore, good to talk with you. How are you?
Good to be with you.
By cultivating empathy and imagination, you say we can all make wiser decisions. What role do empathy and imagination play in sound decision making? What's the role of empathy and imagination there?
They both turned out to be critical, actually. So what I did in this book was to try to approach the problem of decision making not from the standpoint of a psychologist or a social scientist in a laboratory, setting up experiments and seeing how people react in real time. Instead, I took a historian's approach and said, what would happen if we looked at how people made judgments over a broad period of time and facing all kinds of variables, all the things that happen to us in our daily lives, so that history is a very unkind laboratory and we can't run the experiments again. All we can do is look for corroborating evidence and try to see how people behaved when they were actually in real-life situations. And once I did that, looking from ancient Greece to present-day Iraq, in all kinds of realms, from individual decision-making to businesses and organizations, and on the national and international level, certain patterns, distinct patterns, emerged. And they were the things you mentioned, empathy and imagination, are what help people to avoid blunders best. And the ones who couldn't stretch their imagination to think about new solutions, and the ones who couldn't put themselves in the hearts of other people to really think, how would someone experience this situation, someone other than themselves, those are the ones who are most likely to fall into blunders.
Yeah. It's easier said than done, though, isn't it?
Absolutely it is. But what was so interesting about this book is that we can always look back and say, well, hindsight's 20/20, or, you know, if only we had these things, sure, but that's why it's difficult. What I did was I said, well, let's look at these many cases of blunders, and then let's compare them to people in comparable circumstances who didn't blunder, who faced the same kinds of problems, but instead they actually figured out how to avoid them, and they ended up doing three things. The first thing was that they didn't just accept the solutions that were presented to them. Normally, policymakers or doctors will present us, any kind of authority, any established system for decision-making will present us with certain clear-cut choices. They'll say, okay, you can do A, B, or C. A and B are pretty bad choices. C is really the best one we have. The people who were more successful are the ones who said, I don't like A, B, and C. None of them sound very good to me. I'm going to come up with D or E and try something new and creative. Those people with real imagination to come up with new solutions, they were more successful. The second kind of solution people did, you had people who said, I wonder what the people on the other end are really feeling. And they tried to steep themselves and learn as much as they could about the other side, whether it was soldiers trying to learn the enemy better, you name it, or doctors trying to get inside the mind of a patient, on and on. And then the third thing is that the people who avoided blunders were also extremely cognizant of cognition traps. They were clear about what were the common rigid mindsets we all fall into, mm-hmm. and how to avoid those things. They just were conscious of them, and that helped them to avoid blunders.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk in some detail about the cognition traps that you write about in the book. But first, I think it might be more useful to have you tell a story. And maybe we can go back to ancient Greece, to ancient Athens, and the debate between two leaders, Cleon and Diodotus. Want to tell us the story?
Yes. Okay. So this is from Thucydides, who wrote about the Peloponnesian Wars. And there's an incident where a city-state has rebelled against the powerful nation of Athens. And the Athenians decide to punish them by putting all the men to death and enslaving all the women and children. They send off a ship, and then some of them start to have a change of heart, and they think, wait, maybe this is too harsh a punishment. Could this be a mistake? And they have a debate. And Cleon, General Cleon, stands up and says, no, have no mercy on the Mytileneans, these people who've rebelled. Let's kill them all, enslave the women and children. That's what they deserve. Diodotus stands up and he says, you know what? We're making a mistake. The mistake is that we're actually acting against our own best interests. Because if we do this, if we have such a harsh penalty, then we'll only encourage future rebels to fight to the death in future, because that they know that there's going to be no compromise and they're going to die anyway. So we're only going to make our future wars much harder. The other thing he says that's very clever is he realizes that not everyone in this rebel city-state is against them. Some of them could favor Athens. And he says, look, we need to be more compromising so that we can attract the people who actually would like to have Athens to be in the Athenian Empire. And so Diodotus had greater empathy and greater imagination for what to do, and the Athenians end up siding with him, so they avoid the blunder. But then I take that story and say, look, here is setting us up for a common cognition trap, this rigid mindset. We'll call it exposure anxiety, a fear of being seen as weak or flawed. That's what Cleon is saying. If we don't put these rebels down, our other enemies and allies will think that we're weak, and then they'll start rebelling too. That's the kind of logic that gets us into Vietnam and all other kinds of conflicts. It's one more thing about that. The problem is not just that we fear being exposed as weak or flawed, but that it usually leads us to respond with excessive force when moderate mm-hmm. force or diplomacy would be better.
Yeah. Also in this story, I found it very interesting that Diodotus had to refute Cleon's assertion that there was no need for debate, and that Cleon said that considering opposing views was disloyal. And boy, does that kind of thinking get us into trouble.
It has remarkable resonance to contemporary
today,
politics,
doesn't it? Yeah, and you're with us or you're against us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we are talking here from a position of strength, and you will follow.
Well, that's right. So that is a recurrent theme. We see people who don't want to have a discussion or debate. They want to shut things down and then have excessive force. And what Diodotus says is, this is a surest step toward folly. If we don't allow for a thoughtful discussion, then we're almost certain to make mistakes.
Hmm. Responses. force diplomacy. When is a response of force the right response, and how does a nation determine the right level of force? And we take that question, and you can run with it, and then we'll take a look at diplomacy as a right response.
It's a great question. And the answer is that it really does have to be context-dependent. If we try to come up with overly simplistic dogmas for here's what you should always do in this type of situation, that's another way of getting into blunders. And I have a whole chapter on this, something called cure-allism. Cure-allism is when you take a good theory that works well in some circumstances, and then you apply it to places where it doesn't belong. And that's another way of getting into trouble.
Yeah, and we can talk a little more about that in terms of Vietnam and Iraq. But now let's turn to diplomacy. When is it the right response? And how do we come to the table with respect on all sides?
I think that Barack Obama's approach is the right one when he says we need to be willing to sit down and talk with people. Because several things can happen when you do that. You may not achieve your ultimate ends, and very often you won't. That's okay, but you may learn something in the process. You may gather information about the other side just by being with them and having discussions. Information that could help you to avoid a blunder. Another cognition trap I spend a chapter on is called infomania, an obsessive relationship to information. And there were two types of infomaniacs I found in history. One type was the infomisers, people who hoard information and keep it all to themselves and don't share it with colleagues or others who could help them to avoid a blunder. The other type, very common, are the infovoiders, people who shun information. They don't want to learn more, and that is a terrific way of undermining their own success. What Barack Obama is saying is, in our international diplomacy, we must not be infovoiders. We have to be open to lots of information, and then we may learn more things about the other side and be able to have greater empathy and imagination.
Mm. But often there is so much information, and the information may be contradictory.
Yes, this is right. And this has led to a really unfortunate thing, I think, in the public discourse and a lot of the literature today, especially popular books on subjects like this. People say too much information is a dangerous thing, and all you really need is a thin slice of information, and that's the best way to get at what is at the mm-hmm. heart of the problem. I don't agree. We have a lot of examples where people used a great deal of information to understand the other side, and then they were better equipped. The point is that the quantity of information is irrelevant. It's the relevance of any quantity that matters. Having the right information, weeding through information and figuring out what the right information is, that's what we need to do.
So we want good intelligence, for example.
Good intelligence is one thing, but also more important is the way we analyze it. And if we analyze it when we're locked in these cognition traps, in sorts of rigid mindsets, rigid ways of viewing that information, then we won't understand the information we're getting.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, historian Zachary Shore. We're talking with him about his book, Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 in the WILL listening area, in our local area, in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener waiting for us on line one. Hi.
Hi. Welcome, Zachary. I have a question that I'd like to take offline. My question is, what do you do if you're flexible and you're on target, but your leaders are not? Am I clear on that?
You're asking, what do you do about leaders who are making bad decisions, but the public is on target? I think that's the question. I think he's going off the air.
Yeah, he is.
Right. That depends what kind of system you're living in and what kinds of leaders you have, right? In our system, we have a process for removing people who are not responsive. Unfortunately, we have term limits. In other systems, they don't have that option, and sometimes revolution is required to to depose a bad leader. But I think in the more common context, say in a corporation, we often have business leaders who are way off base, and it's very difficult to deal with them. This is a tough problem. Usually what is needed is for enough people, a critical mass, to be able to come forward and say, we're off track, we're making a mistake, and you need to see this. Obviously, it can't always work, and there's so many difficulties in a business environment for people to do that. And then we suffer the consequences. So the best business leaders are the ones who are responsive to the people around them. And that's true of other types of leaders as well, both in the military and politics. It's the ones who are open to information and listening to the people around them. That's what is helpful.
Yeah. I've been struck recently, as have a lot of people recently, by the actions of some workers in Chicago who were due severance pay, and they refused to leave the factory. The factory said, we're closing down within a few days. Good luck. And the workers said, no, it's not right. So they stood up for themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of grassroots coming together collectively as individuals, as citizens, and speaking up to those who are in power.
Right. And with cases like this, you have to think that there are often short-term difficulties, but longer-term benefits. And it's only beneficial over the long term if pressure is maintained from below, right?
Mm.
But if it's only a one-off resistance and then it's over, then the gains are usually not substantial. But let me just broaden that out for a moment into the whole question of the current financial crisis we're in. It's very clearly another example of cure-allism, at least one major part of it. Obviously, some of it stems from greed. But the intellectual justification for what's happening to us now has been a deregulation dogma and the belief that free markets can solve all our problems. And so for decades, we've been deregulating industries that needed tighter regulation. This is all because we had this idea of a cure-all, that markets could solve all our ills. And I think now the bankruptcy of that philosophy has become clear.
Let's take another call. A listener in Eureka, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Hi, a very interesting conversation. A few years ago, David Susskind, the late New York writer, wrote a book. I believe he called it Smart Women, Dumb Choices, and I think the thesis of the book was something like this, that why did so many women, especially, I believe he was using an example of women on the NBA track and business in New York City and urban areas, were highly educated, brilliant, doing well in their job, would make very good choices in business, academia, but yet failed to make wise choices in terms of whom they were married, I guess because of the outcomes being divorced and so forth. Would you have any comment on that kind of decision?
About their personal lives?
Yes. I mean, I guess the idea of how one person could be brilliant in one area and smart in the other, I guess it is human nature. Many of us are very contradictory, but would you have an opinion or comment on that?
I do. I'm so glad you asked that, because actually almost every story in the Splendor book talks about people who were remarkably able to get out of one cognition trap and avoid one type of blunder, and then fell into a different cognition trap at a different time. That's why I knew I had to structure the book in this way, each chapter focusing on a different type of cognition trap or rigid mindset. And so some people were extremely good at avoiding, say, cure-allism or cause fusion, confusing the causes of complex events, or exposure anxiety. But then they'd be terrible at recognizing when they were falling into flat view, for example, seeing the world in one dimension, something that often happens in personal relationships, or mirror imaging, thinking that the other side will behave and act like us. And this is one of the more common problems that happens in interpersonal relationships. Very hard for us to think that the person we're dealing with, whether it's a man dealing with a woman or a worker dealing with a boss or any type of interpersonal relationship, we tend to think that the other person will think and react essentially the way that we do, right? This is a very common problem. We see this every day. And what I tried to do is look at some classic examples of this in interpersonal relationships and also on the battlefield, in international conflicts, and see how people were able to get beyond the mirror imaging cognition trap and avoid the blunder there.
Does the listener want to follow up? No, okay. He's hung up. Very interesting. So why are we so susceptible to these cognition traps?
It's not because we're ignorant. It's because we tend to be rigid. We get locked into rigid patterns of thinking. It's patterns that we're used to, and it's the patterns that we have to break. I try to draw out how these patterns formed in people's minds by going through the extant documentary record and gathering up as much corroborating evidence as I could, things the decision makers said, excerpts of speeches, diaries, memoirs, things like that, and getting into their heads. It was possible to see rigid patterns forming and then occasionally seeing how they would break them. So we do all have a tendency to get locked into thinking in the way that we thought before. And that's one of the hardest things to change. But it can be done. That was the really refreshing part about doing this book, is seeing how people actually snapped out of those patterns.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Zachary Shore, author of Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to talk with our guest, Zachary Shore. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I found the story, one of the stories you tell at the end of the book, to be really fascinating. And that story involves a fellow by the name of Michael May and how he had to, the work he did in order to get out of a very interesting brain, I don't know, how should I put this, Zachary? He had to sort of remake his brain.
Yes, essentially. Yeah. He had to rethink all kinds of things. Essentially what happened was Mike May had been blind almost from birth. When he was 2 or 3 years old, he was in a chemical explosion. And his father was a chemist, and something exploded, a jar that the boy was playing with, and it blinded him, they thought, for life. Well, more recently, a few years ago, because of stem cell research, doctors told him that it might be possible, in his rare case, to restore his sight. And there have been so few cases of a person blind nearly their entire life and then suddenly getting their sight fully restored. They did the operation, and it was amazingly successful. They restored his optics to 100%, but he couldn't see. It was such a fascinating case. The problem was that his brain had been wired in such a way for so long to perform certain tasks non-visually that it was extremely difficult for him to rewire his brain, essentially, to understand the images he was now perceiving. So he could not recognize someone's face. He could not distinguish a male face from a female face. He could not distinguish shapes. He could see colors and he could see movement, but he could not comprehend all sorts of other visual information we get all the time. The doctors told him that there was no hope, that basically his problem was one of cognition and there was nothing more he could do. Mike May is a very inspiring example of someone who worked to overcome cognition traps, because he said, the doctors are telling me the situation is this. I don't like that. I think they're wrong. And I'm going to find a different solution, since their solutions haven't worked. And he came up with the idea of recategorizing everything he sees. And when he did that over a long period of time, he found that he could then recognize objects more readily. Today, his vision is not, or his ability to perceive what he sees, is far from 100%. But it's much better than when he started after the operation, and better than what they thought he would be able to do. And I think the lesson there is, there are several things. He disregarded the options that he was presented with and came up with something new. He innovated a solution. And he was conscious of that cognition trap of falling into the same old pattern of thinking. Might be, in this case, say, a belief that authority always knows the best thing for us and has all the answers. And he did it himself. It's an inspiring story, yes.
No. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Zachary Shore, author of Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. Let's take another call. Now we go to a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, all right. So I'm wondering, you're sort of talking about interpersonal relations. Could you extrapolate this to, let's say, whole subgroups or even culturally, like certain cultures or groups kind of having a common group think where they're really good at perceiving some things, but other things, they fall into these same traps that you're talking about?
Can you give me a more specific
example? Okay, yeah. I'm saying, let's say Americans. This is too diverse a population, but I'm just thinking of, like, you meet people that maybe they're very in scientific professions involving, you know, sort of facts, and they're able to, they're thinking at a very high level. But then when it comes to sort of looking at other things, they're kind of, they'll turn around and sort of believe in what I would call magical thinking, certain New Ageisms, things that are maybe sort of quack medical treatments. So they're sort of like turning off that analytical mindset when they look at certain things. Or even, for example, American society looks at, we want democracy, we have democracy, but the things that we turn or our government turns around and does, and the way it's sort of played out in the media, it's like they're sort of blind to the reality that those other people are experiencing. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yes, okay. Let me try to tackle that. I'm getting some background music there.
A little classical music there in the background. Okay.
Very nice interlude.
Okay. All right.
I think you'd really enjoy the chapter called Cause Fusion, Confusing the Causes of Complex Events. Again, it's one of the most common things we all do. And you see a lot of scientists in all fields doing this because it's so hard to know what the ultimate causes of things are. Now, most people will tell you that the reason we get confused about the causes of things is that we confuse correlation with causation. We see two things happening together, and we say, okay, one must cause the other when there's really no connection between them. That's obvious. I think everyone understands that, even though we still fall into that trap sometimes. I think much more often two different types of cause fusion are occurring. The first is that we miss key links in a causal chain of events. So if there are events going from A through E, we'll identify A and C leading to E, but we'll miss B and D. We overlook them, and then we're completely lost on what's actually happening here. And the other type of cause fusion comes from reversing the causal flow. We think that Y causes X instead of the other way around. I'll give you one quick example, and then I'll try to link this to the question more specifically that you've asked. So, nutrition scientists once tried to figure out what it is in fruits and vegetables that makes us healthy, and they identified beta-carotene. And so they extracted the beta-carotene and put it into supplements, and lo and behold, it gave people cancer rather than curing cancer, okay, which is what they had started out to do. It was the classic definition of a blunder, a solution to a problem that ends up making matters worse. The reason this happened is because they tried to isolate one variable, one link in a causal chain when you needed to have the entire process going on. You needed that beta-carotene of happening being digested inside the body with all kinds of other processes going on. So you needed to see the situation as a whole. You couldn't extract it out. Very often in our daily lives and in our political decision-making, we miss key links and we think that we can focus and zero in on one particular variable and highlight that at the expense of others. And then we miss the entire process as a whole. In politics, for example, we'll look at one key constituency or one key group at the expense of others, or we'll try to come up with a solution that focuses in just on one type of political solution without seeing that it has to function in the country as a whole or in the region as a whole. I know that sounds a little bit abstract, but I hope I can get that main point across to you, missing the key links in the chain. Now, you talked about people who often turn to magical thinking, and I divide the book into two ideas, basically, that there are blunders of the mind, those times when people genuinely tried to solve a problem but made it worse, and blunders of the heart, those times when people fell into things like greed, envy, corruption, superstition, these types of things that have more to do with individual character makeups rather than the way that they were thinking at the time. Does that make sense?
Does the caller want to?
That was a little bit much all at once, I know.
No, it's good. It's good. I guess what I'm wondering, yeah, is that how people in some areas of their life, mm-hmm. they seem to have such a high thinking sort of level,
right.
But then it just turns around and just something slightly different, and
yes.
it's just there's the rationality is gone.
Right. Okay.
Right.
That, to make it more succinct, usually it's a blunder of the heart that will do that. Something to do with an individual character makeup, so a fear about something, anxiety, a greed about something, rather than the people who are those same people at a very high level. They can be thinking very clearly and not falling into cognition traps or rigid mindsets when they're doing their scientific work, but something in their personal makeup ends up leading to a blunder of the heart and can sabotage them in the personal realm.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks
thank
for
you
the
so
call this afternoon. Let's take another call. A listener, excuse me, in Champaign, line two.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi there. Celeste, I'm Helen Wood, and I'm calling from Champaign. You have a historian on your show right now.
Mm-hmm.
And something you said a few minutes ago made me connect the idea that he's a historian with something that is happening these days. You mentioned the people who were sitting in up in Chicago at Republic Windows and Doors,
mm-hmm.
and you mentioned it as if you know as something that made sense and that achieved what they wanted to achieve, and that's the widespread reaction to it these days all over the country. There are reports about this story about these workers who sat in and they managed to get their message across, and they got the Bank of America to reopen the credit line and get them the money that they were legally deserved. But a year ago, if they had done this, don't you think they would have been hauled out of there for trespassing? And that something that has changed profoundly is our view of actions in the context of history. So that if we look at an action that today, you know, today in December 2008 is viewed as rational and brave and creative and historic, and then we look at how it would have been viewed a year ago as criminal, is one of the kinds of blunders that people can make thinking ahistorically?
I am so happy you asked this question. It's the final chapter of the book. The penultimate chapter is called Static Cling, A Refusal to Accept a Changing World. And it's about exactly what you just described. People who get stuck in the idea that things will always be as they've always been. This is really I bring together some fascinating stories along the lines of what you've been describing, how public attitudes change, and how sometimes that can work for the benefit of people, and sometimes it can undermine them as well. But usually what happens is that when people cling to this idea that things will always be the same, and they fail to recognize that fundamental shift in the environment around them, that's when they end up in terrible circumstances.
Mm, very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Historian Zachary Shore, our guest this afternoon, author of Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. The caller before the last one, I want to go back to something that she talked about a little bit, I think. And I think this has to do with the cognition trap of mirror imaging. And she you can help me out here. She talked about how we as Americans think we've got the answer, and here it is, and we're going to give it to you. Maybe here you could talk about, this is one, I think, one of the cognition traps of Iraq, mirror imaging. Talk about Fallujah.
Yes. So we do have this tendency. I feel strongly about this. We tend to think that others will want the things that we want. I think it's more salient in Afghanistan right now, where we see a lot of foreign aid, especially American aid, going to try to build up the infrastructure of Afghanistan, give them roads and bridges, dams and so on, assuming that that will help to modernize the country and spur development, and then they will become more like us. We tried that same approach in Vietnam, giving Vietnamese villagers all kinds of infrastructure programs. Didn't work. And we thought that this would help to win hearts and minds. But in fact, it was the North Vietnamese who were so much better at winning hearts and minds because they got into the heads of Vietnamese villagers and figured out what they really wanted more than roads and bridges was local justice and a traditional way of doing things and opportunities for upward social mobility, all the things that the Americans and the American-backed South Vietnamese government could not offer. I think we risk that in Afghanistan, thinking that we'll just build them up, they'll want what we want, and then they'll be like us. And we tend to think that everyone wants democracy and liberal capitalism the same way that we have it. But when you take societies that are so fundamentally different, have a different way of interacting, different kind of civil society, don't have the same kinds of political institutions, same history, same culture, usually don't get exactly the same wants or in the same way. And we undermine our chances for success in Afghanistan if we keep along this same line of mirror imaging.
Hmm. And what role does static cling play here? Are we changing our strategy? Are we trying to climb out of these traps that we've fallen into?
I think we don't know yet because we don't know exactly what the Obama administration is going to do. So we can only speculate. It looks like there's a chance that they'll take the same strategy from Iraq and apply it to Afghanistan, given the appointment of Petraeus. I don't really know, but it is a danger. I think it's something we have to be cognizant of. If we're going to try and apply the same strategies from Iraq to Afghanistan, they're unlikely to succeed.
Mm. Boy, we've got a lot of cognitive traps here in Iraq, don't we? And in Afghanistan.
Right. And in fact, one of the final chapters, I call it Cognition Trapped in Iraq. And what I show is how in most blunders, one or two or three of the cognition traps I discuss, they'll be present. But in Iraq, it's remarkable because all of the cognition traps I discuss in the book actually combined to undermine our success, at least for the first 5 years in the occupation, in the war and the occupation. And I give examples of how each cognition trap played out to sabotage our success.
Okay. Well, to review here before we take another call, again, these traps are fear of being exposed as weak, confusing the causes of complex events, seeing the world in black and white. We really haven't talked about a flat view trap. Cure-all is in believing one cure solves all problems. Infomania, obsessive control of information, mirror imaging, and static cling.
Could I say one other thing to that?
Sure.
I feel that we've had decades and decades of psychological research and so many Nobel Prizes awarded and research grants and so on. And we've learned a lot about how people think, and yet we still tend to make the same boneheaded decisions in all our lives. What I wanted to do is, from a historian's point of view, give us some things that we could actually hold on to and use. And so what you just did is you ran down the table of contents, which I very intentionally structured in this way, to serve as a cheat sheet. So that even if you never got any further into the book. You could look at the table of contents. I certainly hope you'll read it. But if you didn't, or if you, you know, ideally you would have read the book, and then you'd use that table of contents to jog your memory and say, ah, yes, let me run down this list. Am I falling into exposure anxiety, cause fusion, curalism? And you'll have a quick definition right there of what it is, and then maybe you'll remember some of the stories from the book, and you'll have a palpable response and say, okay, I don't want to end up like the French in Vietnam or the doctor who butchered his patient because he was cause fused or any of these things. So that's the basic idea there.
So we'll be aware of the traps, and then we can challenge the situation and have a better understanding of
exactly.
Making a sound decision.
Right.
Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
I wanted to ask if you've had any help or stimulation from the recent writing. There's a great deal of it now on behavioral economics and social psychology, and in particular what they call confirmation bias, the tendency to see everything that happens as further confirmation of whatever it is you already believe. I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay. I'm glad you asked. In fact, Dan Ariely, who wrote the best-selling book Predictably Irrational, blurb to the back of Blunder, was very kind of him. He's a behavioral economist and has done some interesting work. But what I tried to do is somewhat different. I allowed this work, to be informed by the writings of behavioral economists, psychologists, and all the other social scientists, as well as the cognitive scientists. But the main difference here is that all of the social scientists try to create situations and test people in them to see how they reacted. Historians don't have that luxury. We have to look at how people actually behaved under real-world circumstances. They couldn't isolate variables. They had to deal with all the things coming at them. So we look at a decision maker and say, well, you not only need to know how they responded to these certain options presented to them at work, but you had to know what was happening in their lives at the time. Was the husband or wife sick? Were the kids all right? Was the boss a problem? What was the economic environment at the time, the domestic climate? What was happening in the international arena? All of these things come into play, and historians have to absorb them all and try to sift through them and analyze what were the most important factors shaping people's decisions.
Hmm. Have historians long been interested in cognition and cognition traps?
Well, essentially, yes, but... Yeah. But they haven't approached it in this way. They've been too narrowly focused, I think, on particular types of documents and too much field-specific. And I've tried to broaden out to allow these other fields to inform the work, but still to keep with historical-focused research where you use as much corroborating evidence as possible.
Hmm. Very interesting. Anything you want to wrap up with here this afternoon? Final thought?
I do. I think that although it's a book focused on blunders, it's actually a really hopeful book because it does show how people in all of these comparable circumstances avoided blunders and how they were able to learn greater empathy and strengthen their imaginations and then be cognizant of all of these cognition traps. By doing those three things, people really can make better, wiser decisions in their everyday lives, in everything from international relations to romantic relations. We really can make better, wiser decisions.
Hmm. Zachary Shore, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It was my pleasure.
Zachary Shore is the author most recently of Blunder, Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. Zachary Shore is an associate professor of national security affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School and a senior fellow at UC Berkeley's Institute of European Affairs. You'll find him online at www.zacharyshore.com, S-H-O-R-E. His book, Blunder, is published by Bloomsbury.